Hallo, liebe Hörerinnen und liebe Hörer. Bei dem folgenden Interview mit Peter Molyneux wird euch vermutlich auffallen, dass es an ein paar Stellen hörbare Änderungen in der Tonqualität gibt. Das liegt ganz einfach daran, dass wir dieses Interview in zwei getrennten Sitzungen aufnehmen mussten und sich deswegen zwischendurch die Aufnahmequalität etwas verändert hat. In Gunnars Fall muss man sagen, verbessert hat. Die war leider am Anfang nicht besonders gut, ein Rückfall in alte Zeiten, aber wir hoffen, dass es euren Hörgenuss trotzdem nicht schmälert und wünschen euch viel Spaß mit diesem Gespräch mit Peter Molyneux über Populous.
Another visitor. Stay a while. Stay forever.
Ein Podcast über alte Spiele von zwei alten Männern. Stay Forever mit Gunnar Lott und Christian Schmidt.
Hello, this is Stay Forever, and I'm your host, Gunnar. With me is, as usual, Christian. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Of course, there's our guest. We have the great honor to talk to Peter Molyneux. Peter is one of the legendary game designers. He founded and led two game studios, Bullfrog and Lionhead. He was responsible for beloved games such as Populous, Theme Park, Dungeon Keeper, Black and White, and others. Today, he's retired to a South Sea island and lives in the palace. No, he still runs a game studio, of course. It's called 22 Cans and is most famous for the app experiment Curiosity and the god game Godus. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's a delight to talk to you, Gunnar and Christian.
Peter, we're here today to talk about Populous.
Yeah.
Which is the game that made you, if I may say so. It made you rich and famous and laid the foundation for your reputation as a free creative spirit in gaming.
Absolutely it is, yeah.
If you were to describe that game to my 12-year-old daughter, who has played Minecraft and other games but never heard of this one, what would you say?
That's a very good question. I'd probably start off by saying you play the role of God and you're looking after these little people and you must change the land into flat spaces so that they can spread out and breed. Unfortunately, so is the evil God doing the same. So you must battle with your people against the evil God to keep your people safe.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start years before Populous and trace your path to the game, starting with your education. Did you go to university?
I did. I went to university and I studied computer science. I've got to say, in those days, it was a very, very different subject than it was today because all the programming had to be done on punch cards and paper tape and, you know, you're talking about the very early days of really computers. So whilst it was useful, I don't think it was particularly useful for my career later on. But I really enjoyed university. I went to Southampton.
So you started your career at about 20 years of age when you wrote a business simulation game called The Entrepreneur, and you hoped to sell it from your home via magazine efforts.
Yeah.
That's not an uncommon way to start a game's career in the 80s, but can you give a little context to this episode?
Yeah, to give you the context, I had been working in business for a while and I had worked for this very small retailer as a programmer there. And when I was going to leave, the boss of the company said, well, I give you some money and you set up in business. And so I took, I think it was about 15,000 euros back then. And started a little business up in a tiny office. Well, it wasn't really an office. It was more like a shed. And I thought, well, you know, what should I do? I'll write a game. And indeed, I wrote my first game called The Entrepreneur. And because the person who'd funded the company was a mail order retailer, he had a certain way of working, writing ads. So I wrote this ad for this game called The Entrepreneur. Now, back in those days, everything was a shoot 'em up. You know, everything was based on either Space Invaders or Asteroids or something like that. And so a business simulation was probably the worst business decision I could make. So after the advert came out, I expected there to be, you know, thousands of orders coming through the door. But after a couple of weeks, there'd just been two. And I'm sure one of those was from my mother. So it wasn't the greatest success on the planet.
Little is known about this game, I believe. Can you describe the game in a few more sentences?
Yeah, so, you know, I've always had a love for simulations, and this was a simulation of running a little business, and you had to make products and sell the products, and there was all sorts of world events that were going off with that would disrupt your business. And it was purely a text-based game. There was no graphics at all because it was just me coding it. So if you imagine a screen full of text, a little bit like a spreadsheet with just messages coming up, and you could, you know, buy stock and sell products. And it actually was a great deal of fun, but it's not what the world wanted at that particular time.
I feel it sounds like a game that should have been located into German and it would have done quite well.
Well, maybe so. I mean, it was all written in BASIC, so it was very primitive and crude. But as I said, I liked it. I don't think my mother ever played it. And the mystery other person who bought it, I'd love to one day speak to.
In the following years, you tried your hand at various entrepreneurial endeavors, from selling discs to exporting baked beans, all things. You have told these stories already, so we'll skip those.
Right.
But with the founding of Bullfrog in 1987, together with your longtime business partner, Les Edgar, mm-hmm. you pivoted back to games.
Yes.
So why was that?
I will give a bit of context to the baked beans story. The real reason I really started this company called Taurus Impex was because I had fallen for this girl called Camille. You know, I was just so besotted with her. And I met her father, and her father was this kind of influential Swiss person. He said, you know, you should forget about computer games and stuff. You should start a business in import exporting. And so I think I really did that because I wanted to, you know, get off with this girl called Camille. But it never really sat well with me. And, you know, I was still tinkering around with games even back then. So it was a sensible move to start Taurus. It was just hormones, I think, more than anything else. So there was a reason to start games up again. That's what I did.
There seems to be an ongoing theme where people give you money. Would you describe yourself as charming? And charming, you know, at getting investors? I still can't get past the 15,000 euros somebody gave you.
Well, it sounds like that, but Camille's father never gave me any money. He just said, why don't you do this? Actually, back in my 20s, I was the geekiest geek you could possibly imagine. You know, I loved my computer so much, and I loved playing games so much. And this is back in the day when, you know, games were really frowned upon, and it was considered a complete waste of human life to play a game back in the 80s. As for being charming, absolutely not. I could just about communicate with other people that could program, but, you know, I was definitely not charming or extrovert or anything like that. That seemed to magically come later.
So Taurus Impex was doing business applications, as I understand it.
Yeah, it was business applications and importing and exporting. And that sounds very grand, but actually it wasn't. I think we made about as much money as we needed to eat baked beans and baked potatoes. That's all we could afford. So we were making virtually nothing.
What was the opportunity that you had to go back into games? What happened there?
I had a friend who was a programmer called Andrew Bailey. And, well, we have to skip back a little bit because I've told this story before about how Commodore got the wrong company name and phoned us up and said, you know, we'd love to show you the Amiga. And they showed us the Amiga. And then they said, you can have all these free computers. And we realized that they'd got the wrong company name rather than us, an import and export company. So that meant I had, you know, six of these original Amiga computers arrive in the office and, you know, nothing to do with them. But a friend of ours called Andrew Bailey said, oh, why don't you convert this game onto the Amiga? Because I know that's something that a publisher would pay you money for. And indeed, they paid us about 6,000 euros, which was more money than I'd ever seen in my life before. I mean, the fact it ended up being almost a year's work, but that gave me the computers, it gave me the reason to do it. And indeed, I did a conversion of this game called Druid 2 across the Amiga. And so I had my foot in the door, as it were.
There was also a little drum machine application called A-Drum, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, gosh, you've done your research. I've almost forgotten about A-Drum.
Was that before the port of Druid or afterwards, if you remember?
I think that was before. Do you know, it's so hard to remember. In fact, there was a title even before that that was called The Composer, which was a music generation program where you could, you know, enter notes on the keyboard. And that was for the Commodore 64. And I can remember we got an order for about 1,000 of these tapes. There were tapes back then, not discs or CDs or anything. And I can remember being in my bedsit copying those tapes over the whole weekend and then getting to the end of copying these 1,000 tapes just on two basic tape decks and realizing that none of them had recorded properly. And that was probably one of my worst times of my life. And then I delivered all these tapes with this music program off to the publisher, and he took them but never paid me any money. The bizarre turn of fortunes there is I went back to see him and said, you know, why haven't you paid me the money? And he said, well, you know, we're not going to pay you the money. We didn't ever agree to it. And I said, well, you got the tapes. He said, well, it's just tough luck. You can't have the money. And then years later, after I sold Bullfrog, I was looking around for a house, a new house to move in. And the guy that made the deal was selling his house because he was going bankrupt. And when I was looking around at the house, I met him again. I said, you probably don't recognize me, but you're the one. You shafted me for this money way back then. And that was quite pleasurable, really, to get my revenge.
Did he apologize?
No, he didn't, actually. He just stormed off as if I was going to knife him or something. But the house wasn't very nice, so I didn't end up getting that house.
Take us back into the year 1998, like shortly after Bullfrog was founded and when the development of Populous really began. Let's say you arrive at the office in the morning. Can you describe what you see there? Who is there? What people are doing?
Right. So at that time, there was me and someone called Glenn Corpus, and we worked together in this office that was about as big as a toilet, I think. The office was at the top over the flat of this old woman called Kath, and we managed to get this free room where we didn't have to pay any rent. And this tiny room that the two of us worked in was full of pizza boxes and cans of Diet Coke. And I had this massive cigarette ashtray, and it was just about 6 inches high of cigarette butts. It stunk of cigarettes, Coca-Cola, pizza, and body odor. So much so, if anyone walked in the office, they gagged because the smell was so bad. That was my working, but there was no toilet in the building. We had to use this tiny little sink that we had. I won't go into details about that, but it was the most horrible existence you could possibly imagine.
Could you introduce Glenn Corpus to us? What type of person was he, and how did you hire him?
We hired him as a graphic artist, but he did all the graphics on Druid. But he also dabbled in, you know, programming and other stuff like that. And he was, and he still is, he is, you know, I've changed a lot since those days, but he is precisely the same. He looks the same. He talks the same. He does the same sort of stuff he did back then. And he was very kind of laser focused on the thing that he did. So if he was doing graphics, he did fantastic graphics. He did all the graphics for Populous. And, you know, at that time, we used to work, I mean, God knows how many hours a day we worked, but it was a lot. And then we used to go down the pub, have some drinks, go home, sleep, get up, go to work the next day. Neither of us had any partners or girlfriends or anything. we just lived to work. Well, it wasn't really work. It was more an unbelievable, incredible experience of creating things even back then.
When you were setting out to do Populous, you described the beginning as very iterative, and we'll get to that a little bit more in a moment. But were you setting out, so this is our next game and let's start this? Or is this more like goofing around, trying different things while doing other things, everything in parallel?
Yeah, it was absolutely that. There was no plan. We didn't say, oh, well, we need to start another game now. We were just turning up to work every day and doing shit, if you excuse my language. We were, you know, just riffing every day. And so one day I walked in and there were some graphics that Glenn was drawing on the screen, and there were these isometric blocks. And I said to him, oh, that's really interesting. Send me those blocks and I'll play around with them. And that's how Populous started. It was no idea, you know, when Glenn was drawing the blocks and when I was coding it, there was no real idea of what we were doing. You didn't do a game design back then. It was just, well, you know, let's play around with something and see what happens.
Bottom-up approach, so to say.
The very bottom of bottom-up approach, yeah. I think that's being generous.
It was just the two of you starting with the game, and what kind of role did Les play?
He was a really good friend of mine, but he had a job up in London. And so he was around for going to the pub, for sure, but he didn't get involved in either coding or any of the art or anything like that because he had another job. You know, when I say we had no money, I really, really mean we had absolutely no money. So, you know, I think all of our money just went on paying Glenn. I don't think I drew a salary or any form of salary for years. I just worked out this way of being able to stay alive by taking out different credit cards. So I'd take out, you know, an American Express card and then take it up to the credit limit, and then take out a Barclay card and take it up to the limit. And that's how I survived for years and years.
So the two of you, Glenn and you, started developing the game in a kind of back and forth. And it grew into a team eventually. So like six persons, or how long was it just the two of you?
I mean, basically what happened is I took the blocks from Glenn. I formed those blocks into a landscape so that you could have water. And then Glenn drew the water blocks. And then I said, well, can we have a slope for the coast? And can we have a flat block? And so we ended up with this landscape, which was 64 blocks by 64 blocks. And it was only at that point I thought, well, what can I put on the landscape? So I said, well, why don't we have these little people moving around? And so Glenn drew these animations of these little people. There were just two frames of animation, one frame with the leg forward, one frame with the leg back. He gave me those, and then I put those little people on the landscape. And then I realized I've got to get them moving around. And this is the moment that Populous was actually born, because I realized, you know, I couldn't think of a way of having lots of these little people use navigation so that they would walk up to the coast and walk left or walk right, or they'd be able to navigate around, you know, obstacles. You know, because I couldn't work out how to do it because the computer would slow down too much. So instead, I just made it so that when you clicked on the map, it would raise a bit of land that a little person could walk over. My inability to code navigation or pathfinding routines caused the core of what Populous was to be created. So that was the first real evolution of what Populous became. And then the second evolution is that, you know, I'm an insanely competitive game player. You know, I love board games. I love any cooperative game. So Glenn and I wired up our two computers so that we could play on the same landscape. And it was that that caused the people to start fighting. And then we started to think, well, this kind of feels a bit godlike. And then we introduced the god powers. And we used to play Populous all the time, you know, for 3 or 4 hours a day. And my rule was, right, if I'm not winning, the game's not finished. So we just kept adding features in. Every time Glenn won, I used to add a new rule or a new part of the game that made sure that I won.
So this was, in inception and the longest time during development, a pure multiplayer game. When and why did this change to a single-player experience?
We still left the multiplayer element in there, but the main reason we had to do a single-player experience, to play at multiplayer, you had to swap two pins on the RS-232 lead. The RS-232 port on the Amiga was designed to plug into a printer. It wasn't really designed to plug into another computer. But if you took a lead apart and swapped two of the pins over, it means that you could connect two computers. Obviously, you know, if you release that game, no one was going to be able to do that. So we said, well, let's write a simple computer opponent.
I'm curious about the relationship between Bullfrog and Electronic Arts. You've often spoken about the business side of things, about the contract that you had with EA and the royalties and so on. But how about the production side? Which aspects of Populous, as we know it today, were influenced by Electronic Arts?
Well, very little, actually, because there came a point where I can remember this day vividly, where Les came back and he said, you know, we've completely run out of money. There's no money left. We're going to have to close the business down. And I said, well, look, just give me a few more weeks just to get the game to a level that we can show publishers. And so we scrimped and saved. I don't think Glenn took any money for a month, and we managed to get the game almost as it looks now, except for a few missing pieces. And we started taking it around to publishers. And initially, that went incredibly badly. It was terribly depressing because you went to a publisher, showed them the game, and they'd say, what's this? You know, they were still talking about the 80s, the late 80s here. What's this? We've never seen anything like this. Could you make it into a game like this game? And we said, no, we can't do that. And I think we went around to see about 10 or 12 publishers before we went to Electronic Arts. And then very fortunately, Electronic Arts were just established just earlier that month that we showed them. They'd established their European arm and they didn't have anything to really publish. And so when we took Populous round to them, they said, yeah, we'll take this game. But it was almost finished then, except there was one big missing piece. We signed the publishing deal with them, and I think the game was released, you know, a month later after signing the publishing deal, and they put it into their test. Now, testing back then, it consisted of one person testing the game for 48 hours. That was it. That was the complete testing. And this one person who tested the game, they phoned us up and said, well, we've tested the game, but how do we get to the end screen? And I realized that we didn't have an end of game screen. We haven't written one. And I said, well, we haven't written it yet. And they said, well, you're going to have to finish it. Whatever you do, you're going to have to finish it today because we've got the disc duplication booked and we can't get that. So we had to go back and this friend of Glenn's had drawn this picture of this weird goblin lord, and we managed to change the graphics. So at the end of the game, this goblin lord raised his left eyebrow, and then the text said, well done, you finished the game. But that was a real panic.
I'm sure that was very rewarding for players who finished the game to see.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was terrible. Yeah.
I've read stories that adding the single player was actually a suggestion from Joss Ellis, from the producer at Electronic Arts, which you had back then.
I mean, Joss became a really close friend. I don't remember him doing anything. The person who did add something was, and he went on to work with me for a long time, was called Tim Rantz. Tim worked out that if an Amiga was connected on a network, now back then, you know, very few people connected on a network, then you could write a file with the multiplayer codes on. And the multiplayer worked on a 300 board modem. It could send and receive 30 bytes a second. And the whole of Populous worked on that. And I can remember Tim specifically doing the code for that. As far as Joss is concerned, I don't remember him. He didn't do any development. He was the main producer there. I mean, I'm sure he had some suggestions on the single player game, but I'm pretty sure we had a single player game before Electronic Arts took it on.
So regardless, for the longest time during development, that was a multiplayer game. It was conceived as a multiplayer game. And
yeah.
You enjoyed it as a multiplayer game.
Yeah.
And as it was released, it had this campaign mode included. Ultimately, how important was network play for the success of Populous?
Not at all.
Almost all the games I've done have had some form of connectability to it. You know, Syndicate could be played multiplayer, Magic Carpet could be played multiplayer, Power Monger could be played multiplayer, Dungeon Keeper obviously could be played multiplayer, even Black and White, and even Fable had this weird co-op mode. So I've always had a passion for it. It's been more of a passion because it's not until really the explosion of the internet and internet gaming that multiplayer was really an important factor in the games industry, I think.
So do you think that people who played Populous by themselves back then didn't get the full Populous experience?
No, I totally agree with that. Whatever you do with AI, I never think it can replace that kind of visceral hatred you have for your opponent if you're playing another human being.
Well put.
There's a couple more people in the official credits, which you haven't mentioned yet, but most prominent is Rob Hubbard, who did the title music. And you describe yourself as, you know, like still an outsider, small company, lucky to be saved by Electronic Arts. But Rob was already a star, wasn't he? So how did you get him?
Absolutely. Well, that was Electronic Arts who organized that. And they did a really fantastic job of getting Rob Hubbard. And he did a brilliant piece of music. We never met him. He was one of these kind of godlike figures from the 1980s. And they say he supplied us with the music. And it was just outstanding what he did on the composition there. Because we also did the ST version. The sound on the ST was pretty rubbish. And he did some amazing work on that. I think also there was someone called Matt Hanlon. I think he did some sounds as well.
David Hanlon.
David, of course. Matt Hanlon sits about three desks away from me at the moment. So, and again, back in those days, there were no sound effect libraries. We wanted to do this swamp sound effect, and he did it by throwing a wet sponge into a bath with us holding a microphone. And, you know, that's how you made sound effects back then.
There's something that I wonder, Peter, because you were mentioning the dismal financial situation that Bullfrog was in during the development of Populous. And the development of Populous took some time, I guess, half a year or something like that.
I think it took about 9 months from me walking through the door and seeing those blocks to it being released. Yeah.
Okay, that's quite some time.
It was.
For that time in particular. And at the same time, you having these financial constraints and basically living on a dime. I'm wondering what mindset were you in back then? Because if I had been in your place, I would have panicked. I don't think I would have worked for 9 months on a game, given that your history at that point was one of not having had big successes yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had no dependents. I had no people that relied upon me. There was just me. And if everything went wrong, you know, what's the worst that could happen? That's the view I took back then. You know, I've got nothing. I might as well just carry on doing what I'm doing now until I either get thrown in jail because of the debts I've got or that someone comes and shoots me or something. There wasn't a feeling of risk at all. It's only when you get a girlfriend and then you get married and then you have children and then, you know, they all depend on you. That's when I think risk really comes into the forefront of your mind. But back in my 20s, I mean, I had no plan. I never thought I would ever be anything but a bumbling geek that loved computers more than he loved human beings almost. So, you know, there was no feeling of risk at all. I think that's probably true of a lot of people in their late teens and early 20s. You know, I can certainly recognize it from my son, who's 18 now, and he's got no real concept of risk in the same way that we do as we get older, because people start depending on us. So I just lived every day as it came rather than worry about whether I could afford a meal in a restaurant. I did go out occasionally. I can remember I went out, there's this girl called Tina, who I really liked, and I really wanted to impress her, so we went to a restaurant, and then my credit cards were cut up in front of me at the table, and she had to pay. I didn't see her again. You know, so there were people that I was seeing, but it was a pretty dismal existence.
Your son has the benefit of having a wealthy father, which takes away a lot of the existential angst that one might have.
Yes.
But I mean, you were redeemed in the sense that Populous was a tremendously successful game and also made a lot of money for Bullfrog and for yourself. Did all the sudden riches, did they spoil you?
Well, I can remember the phone call that David Gardner, who was the current marketing manager at Electronic Arts, phoned me up after the launch and said, you know, congratulations, you're a millionaire. You know, and this was me sitting in the office that had no toilet and, you know, the mountain hide ashtray. What he omitted to say was it was going to be another 9 months before we saw any of that money. And that forced us to sign a pretty bad deal with Electronic Arts just so we could get some money to live, basically, for 3 further titles. But then the money did arrive, and I can remember very, very clearly walking through the high street of Guildford and thinking to myself, I can afford anything in any of these shops. And immediately after that was one of the most miserable, depressing times of my life. And I ended up having therapy because it was as if someone had just changed my life instantly. We were having to employ lots of people. Lots of people were now relying on me. Lots of people were looking at me for the next game design. There was a lot of press going on. And before that, I had nothing and no one knew me and no one relied on me. And suddenly overnight, that completely changed. And it was very, very distressing, I have to say. The next most distressing part of my life was probably when I sold Bullfrog, because that was even more distressing. If someone suddenly changes your whole life for the better, you know, infinitely better because you got money, it is very unsettling.
Did you feel that you deserved all that money?
I never felt like a proper programmer or a proper games person. You know, as soon as Populous was finished, we had to sign this deal with Electronic Arts for 3 more titles. And so literally the moment that Populous was finished, we had to start on the next game, which was Powermonger. And I can remember the press had come for the first time and visited me. And, you know, I was being interviewed and I was talking in the press and really learning how to talk in the press. And I can remember there was a journalist, this kid, called Gary Witter, who is now a really famous screenwriter in Hollywood. Anyway, he was this young 17-year-old who would come and just stay at the bottom of the stairs and wouldn't go away. And he organized this round table with me, Jez San, Archer MacLean, David Braben. That was the 4 of us. And we sat around a table and, you know, these were unbelievable gods that I have grown up with. You know, there was Jez San, he did Star Glider. There was David Braben, he did Elite. And there was Arch MacLean, and he did IK Plus. And, you know, there was me that did Populous. And Populous had only just come out. And we're all sitting around the table, and it was very, very quiet. And they were all talking about coding, and they all used Assembler. I wrote Populous in C. And, you know, they were saying, you've got to write games in Assembly. And they turned around to me and they all looked at me and said, Peter, what did you write Populous in? And I said, well, C. And they literally laughed. And so I went back to the office that night and I threw all the code that I had done for Powermonger away and wrote it all in Assembler, which was just the most ridiculously stupid thing to do. So I felt like an imposter in the games industry. I didn't feel like I was anywhere near the level of these gods that I looked up to.
Now, Populous was finished and delivered to EA for production, and it was released. It would become a huge hit and you would become rich, but you didn't know that yet. So what did you do next?
It was just a relief to get my first real game out. Obviously, it was a huge relief. And because we were short of money and the populist money hadn't arrived, we signed up 3 other games with Electronic Arts. And then I got on almost the next day with the next game. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It wasn't the next game yet. The first thing that happened is that we did a data disc, The Promised Lands. And we didn't have much time to do it because Electronic Arts wanted it out quickly. Fortunately, with Populous, all the landscapes were randomly generated. So we didn't have to kind of design the levels. We just had to play them. So we just slapped some numbers in there and blended some more art. And we released that as well, which sold very well as well.
At that point where you made the decision to release the data disc or where Electronic Arts requested it, was it already apparent that Populous would be successful?
Yeah, it was totally apparent. You know, it was number one. While all this was going on as well, I mean, this was an incredibly confusing time. While this was going on, the Japanese had heard about Populous and Electronic Arts didn't have a publishing arm in Japan. So we got this phone call. Bear in mind, the office was in this horrible flat above this old woman called Kath. And the president of Seito, which was this huge Japanese corporation, had taken it on himself to visit us without much notice. And so we got a phone call saying, oh, we're in the area. Could we come and see you? And we said, yes. But unfortunately, this president arrived in a, you know, big black limousine and got out and started walking up the stairs to our office through Kath's flat, because you had to walk the stairs through Kath's flat. And she chased him away with a broom because she thought she was being attacked by someone. So he phoned up and said, I can't get into your office because this old woman keeps pushing me away. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we did a deal with a company called Imagineer in Japan. They released Populous in Japan and it was a huge success in Japan.
The release in Japan, that was for the SNES, if I'm not mistaken, for the Super Nintendo?
I think they did the home computer first. And then I think they did the SNES version. We sent them the code. But it was just an insane time because we'd gone from this totally unknown developer to having presidents of companies visit us and, you know, these crazy phone calls from Electronic Arts.
So Populous was originally an Amiga game?
Yes, Amiga and ST.
ST, right. But it was also released for DOS.
Yeah.
And I think it was Glenn Corpus who mentioned in an interview that you did the PC port, even though you didn't have much experience programming on a DOS machine.
That's correct. I mean, DOS back in those days was a hateful beast. it had a multitude of graphics cards, and the graphics cards it did have had these weird resolution, like you had the CGA version, which you could only have 4 colors on screen, and they were just awful colors. And then there was a Hercules card where you could have it in green and black, but much higher resolution. So I think we supported 8 cards in the end, but it was a complete and utter nightmare to do.
Why did you do that yourself?
Well, there was simply nobody else. You know, it was me and Glenn and one other person called Kevin. And we were looking for other coders. But, you know, these were the days where if you were a programmer trained at university or college, you didn't even think of the games industry as being a place that you could get a job. So we really had to hunt round for people to employ. And we were incredibly lucky because we employed someone called Sean Cooper, who came to us on a youth training scheme, but he turned out to be this brilliant programmer. He really helped out. But it was just a crazy, totally disorganized time. And looking back, I have no idea how we did in the space of a year, just over a year, we did a data disc and we did Powermonger, which was the next game after Populous.
After a hit game like Populous, from today's point of view, a sequel would have been logical. However, you developed Powermonger instead, which is kind of similar but different.
Well, back in those days, and this is unbelievable when you think of today's world, it was considered artistic bankruptcy to do a sequel. It was just selling out. That was the word that the magazines all used. Oh, they're just doing a sequel. They're just cashing in. So we didn't really want to do a sequel straight away. And then Powermonger was this crazy attempt at a real-time strategy game when there were no real-time strategy games around at that time. It was just the idea of commanding troops and battling on a landscape, which we thought would make a good game. I mean, like a lot of the games that I've worked on, it was kind of made up as we went along. But it was very, very pressured, and we were working even longer hours. You know, it was just a crazy, crazy time.
Did it work out commercially?
Yeah, I mean, it got to number one. It didn't, because of a stupid design decision that I made, and this is kind of a lesson I learned, is you should never let the logic of something get in the way of the gameplay. So in Powermonger, you had all these troops on the landscape which you could give orders to and command and fight, you know, just like a real-time strategy game, really. But I thought, well, how do these troops get the messages from you? And I made the decision that when you sent them a command, so if you clicked on an area of the landscape, a pigeon flew out and sent the orders to them. And there was this, like, this 30-second delay, which just made the game feel awful. So I think I learned a good lesson about them.
Powermonger had 3D terrain that was zoomable and rotatable and allowed for much more varied landscapes. For Populous 2, however, you returned to the checkerboard structure. Why was that?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why is I think that we could support 8 polygons for the landscape. It was either 8 or 16. There's not much you can do with 8 polygons. And of course, Populous required, you know, a big landscape. And in those days, with the performance of the machines, it would just be out of the question to have done the landscape using polygons rather than using blocks.
You always seem to have given young people chances throughout your career, people from outside the industry often.
Well, I've always believed in two things. You can find brilliance in people. If you can pull the brilliance out of someone, they can do an amazing job for you. And I've had incredible success with that. I've worked with a lot of people when they were very, very young. Maybe they didn't have any opportunities like Sean, and they've gone on to be very significant people in the industry. So I've always believed in that. And I think part of the reason I believed in it is that, you know, I didn't really have any much in the way of chances. And, you know, if it hadn't been for just a crazy number of lucky coincidences, I wouldn't have got anywhere. So I really believe in giving people a chance. And to a certain extent, having the freshness and enthusiasm of someone who wants to really start in the games industry compared to someone who's been in the game industry for a long time, quite often you find that they come up with things that other people wouldn't, because they don't perhaps know the formal approach, and that means the informal approach can often pay off. So I'm a great believer in that, even to this day.
Speaking of hiring people, there's actually a question that has haunted me for quite a while. I think it was around 2010 that you visited the GameStar offices for an interview for Making Games magazine, speaking about business and stuff. And in passing, you mentioned that when hiring people, you base the decision
handshake
on their hands. Right. And we didn't press the subject back then, but I've been wondering ever since, what are you looking for in their hands?
It's very hard to describe in words, but there's a certain handshape. There is some research that's been done on that. There's a certain handshape for people who are very skilled at mathematics. There's another handshape for people who are very creative and imaginative. And I have actually used that. In fact, I used that in an interview only last month. You know, the science behind it maybe not be as robust as it should be, but the correlation between brilliant people and a certain handshape is the length of the fingers and the proportion between the forefinger and the index finger, which I look for. It's worked for me. You know, I've used it for a very long time. You have to do something when you're interviewing people, because if you've got 100 CVs and you've spoken these days to 100 people over Zoom, how do you distinguish one above the other, other than, you know, maybe one looks like an axe murderer and the other one looks like, you know, someone who's the nicest person in the world? You don't really know. And so you just use whatever tricks you can. And the handshape is one of the tricks I use. And another trick that I use is to give set people a riddle and just observe how they go about solving that riddle. It is just very insightful as to whether they would be a great person to work with.
Interesting. Thank you for clearing that up. I can sleep easy now.
Yeah, I know it's eccentric.
It's unusual.
And if you were applying for a banking position or something like that, you'd think it was mad. But, you know, I know I'm eccentric. So there you go.
You've been telling us about your younger years, getting started in the business, your first steps as an entrepreneur. And it seems to me that in your younger years, your ambition was not necessarily to be a game designer, but rather to be a businessman, an entrepreneur. Yeah. And now, decades later, you have created quite a few games and you have started quite a few companies. Yeah. So if you take stock now, in which of these fields have you succeeded more?
You know, I mean, my first business was when I was 14 or 15. I think I got together all my sister's friends who were, you know, 12 and 13 years old, and I rented them out doing gardening in people's gardens. And that was my first real business. You know, I gave them some money, but, you know, I kept some money as well. You know, I just had these childish fantasies about running my own business. I think mainly because my dad was so miserable working for a company, and I think that just rubbed off on me.
So do you consider yourself a game designer or a businessman first and foremost?
Well, I mean, there's three sides, and this drives people absolutely mad. Well, there's four sides to me, really. Firstly, I'm a programmer. Other than the gap I took between black and white and starting 22 Cans, most of my time has been spent coding. Certainly on my latest project has been spent coding. So firstly, I'm a coder. Secondly, a designer. Thirdly, a director of a company, you know, like a businessman. And maybe fourthly, in the past, it has been, you know, involved in the press side. So, and that drives people mad here, because they never know which Peter they're talking to, whether they're talking to the designer Peter, the coder Peter, or the businessman Peter.
And which of these Peters makes the decisions? For instance, selling Bullfrog, which of the Peters made that decision?
I mean, that was an insane time. You've got to realize that Electronic Arts tried to buy us once and we said no. And then there were seven companies trying to buy Bullfrog. You know, we were traveling all over the world. And the partner I had at that time, Les Edgar, you know, he desperately wanted to cash in. So I can't remember what sold it to me. I mean, it was an incredible deal. You know, it was cash on day one. And
it was temptation.
It wasn't temptation. It was just, I can't really recall what was going through my mind back then. It was just so exciting. I can remember that Philips wanted to buy us and they said, oh, can you come over to New York? And so they put me on a plane to New York on Concorde. You know, for a bloke who just 3 years before was having to fend off bailiffs from taking all his possessions, I mean, it was like some fairy tale. It really was. But the rationale of doing it, the business rationale of doing it, actually wasn't particularly sensible. Because looking back now, Bullfrog was very, very successful. It was doing incredibly well. All the staff were really, really happy. We probably could have got an awful lot more for the company, but, you know, who's to say at the end of the day?
That kind of wraps it up nicely. Thank you very much, Peter, for taking the time to speak with us. It was very interesting, as always. Thanks again, and have a nice Christmas.
Thank you very much, and I hope you have a great Christmas.